Hi folks, it's another recorded session and I apologize again for it being recorded, but I'll be back live next week. And for this week, I'm exhausted, but it's been fun. But let's talk about where we left off last session. I'm assuming you watched the last recorded session. We've looked at the variables that drive multiples. We started with PE ratios and we moved on to PEG ratios, price to book, and then now we're going to talk about EV to EBITDA. The mechanism we use is actually a very simple one. We go back to a discounted cash flow model. With an equity multiple, we go back to the simplest discounted cash flow model we can think of, which is a stable growth dividend discount model. With an enterprise value multiple, you go back to the simplest enterprise value model that you can think of, which is a stable growth free cash flow of the firm model. Remember, the value of a firm in a stable growth free cash flow of the firm model is expected free cash flow of the firm next year divided by cost of capital minus the growth rate. Let's use that process to extract the variables that drive EV to EBITDA multiples. After all, this is one of the most widely used multiples in the world, and I think a lot of people who use it don't really understand what they need to control for when they use that multiple. They use rules of thumb like 6x EBITDA is cheap. Let's see if that's true. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take free cash flow to the firm and expand it. You're saying, what do you mean? Normally, the way we write free cash for the firm is EBIT times 1 minus D plus depreciation minus CapEx minus change in working capital. That is the conventional definition. I've just rewritten it slightly. And here's what all I've done. If essentially I've looked at EBITDA instead of EBIT. So I've taken EBITDA times 1 minus D. But because I've done that, instead of adding back the depreciation, I've packed just the tax rate times depreciation minus CapEx, minus change in working capital. Trust me, I'm not doing anything to the equation. I'm just moving some terms around. You see, why are you doing that? It's nice to have EBITDA on the right-hand side. If I'm going to have an EV to EBITDA multiple, it just makes my algebra simpler. That's the only reason. So I divide both sides of that equation by EBITDA. And here's what I get. On the left-hand side of the equation, I get EV to EBITDA. And here are the variables that drive EV to EBITDA. Let's go term by term. The first is, what kind of tax rate do you have? The higher the tax rate you have as a company, the lower the EV to EBITDA. And think of what? EBITDA is a pre-tax number. So let's take an extreme case where you're in a country where the government takes 100% of your income in taxes. You would be willing to pay anything for that company, right? And so as the tax rate rises, the EV to EBITDA should get lower. File these away because we're going to come back and talk about the perfect undervalued firm with an EV to EBITDA basis. The questions to ask when somebody's trying to sell you a company based on EV to EBITDA. First off is, what's your tax rate? In the denominator, you have two numbers that also drive EV to EBITDA. Other things remaining the same, the higher your cost of capital, the lower the EV to EBITDA should be for your firm. Why? Riskier firms should trade at lower multiples of EBITDA. The higher your growth rate, the higher EV to EBITDA. Already we have three variables, your tax rate, your cost of capital, and your growth rate. Now there are three other variables, but you can actually consolidate them because if you take depreciation, CapEx, and change in working capital, that consolidated value is reinvestment. So the higher the reinvestment that a company needs to get a certain growth rate, in other words, it's a less efficient company in terms of delivering growth, the lower the EV to EBITDA. So here are the determinants of EV to EBITDA. The first is your cost of capital. The higher your cost of capital, the lower the EV to EBITDA. The second is your growth rate. The higher your growth rate, the higher EV to EBITDA. The third is your tax rate. The higher the tax rate, the lower the EV to EBITDA. And the final variable is the reinvestment rate, or put differently, the return on capital. Companies with high returns on capital will be able to get the same growth with a lower reinvestment rate and get a higher EV to EBITDA. Now, as we go through these pricing discussions, what I'd like you to think about is not the equations, but the kinds of questions you can ask now when somebody tries to sell you something based on a multiple. Let me explain. Let's assume I'm a private equity guy. I come to you and say, look, I have a really cheap company for you. It's trading at 4.5x EBITDA. Sounds cheap, right? So ask me some questions. What's the first question you're going to ask me? What's your cost of capital? In 50% of the cases, it might be 15, 20, 25%. My company's really risky. That's why it trades at a low EV to EBITDA. Second, you've got to ask me, what's my growth rate? And it's probably going to be negative or low because that then explains the low EV to EBITDA. The third question you should ask me is about the tax rate I face. Maybe I'm in a locality that has an 80% tax rate. That would explain my low EV to EBITDA. And the final question you should ask me, what kind of returns on capital do I earn in a normal year? And if my answer is 3 or 4% returns on capital, That explains the low EV/EBITDA. I've said this before, but I'll say it again. Most companies that look cheap deserve to be cheap. So when you see a company trading at a low EV/EBITDA, most of the time it deserves to trade at that low EV/EBITDA, either because it has a high cost of capital, a low growth rate, a high tax rate, or a low return on capital. But there's hope still left in the world. You can still find a cheap stock, and here's what a cheap stock will look like on an EV/EBITDA basis. It'll have a low cost of capital, it'll have a high growth rate, it'll have a low tax rate, and it'll have a high return on capital. Again, you're saying, what chance do I have finding something like this? No harm looking. So think of screening for stocks on that basis, and you will have the basis for finding stocks that are underpriced on EV/EBITDA basis. So I'm going to use a hypothetical company again to illustrate how EV/EBITDA would change as the variables change. So I'm going to value a stable growth company expected to grow 5% a year forever. Different setting, different kinds of growth rate allowed. It has a cost of capital of 10%. Its tax rate is 36%. Its capex as a percentage of EBITDA is 30%. The depreciation is 20% of EBITDA. It has no working capital requirements. So here's what I do. I go in and plug the numbers into the equation from the previous page because it's a mature company in stable growth. I put in a 36% growth rate, a 10% cost of capital, a 5% growth rate. That 20% is my depreciation. My capex is 30%. That's my tax rate again. There's no working capital requirement. So my EV to EBITDA for this company, assuming it's fairly valued at its intrinsic value, would be 8.24 times EBITDA. Again, remember, you're not going to be plugging these numbers in for your company because there's no point in doing it. That would just give you the intrinsic value of a company if it's a mature company. But here, the reason I did this is to ask some what-if questions. Here's the first what-if question I asked. What would happen to that EV to EBITDA if my tax rate were different from 36%? So the answer is easy. As my tax rate goes from to 40 or 50%, my EV to EBITDA goes from 8.24 down to less than 6. Doesn't make it cheap, just the tax rate went up. If my tax rate was 0% in this company, my EV to EBITDA would be close to 14. So high tax rate companies will have low EV to EBITDA multiples. So you're saying, when would this ever be the case? Let's say you're an analyst tracking European airlines, and in your sample set, you have Ryanair, you have Lufthansa, you have Swissair, you have a bunch of companies in different countries with different tax rates. Which company is going to look expensive on an EV to EBITDA basis? Think of the choices in Europe and think of the tax rate as your defining variable. In which country are the tax rates the lowest? Oh, Ireland, right? So Ryanair is going to look expensive relative to Lufthansa. It isn't expensive, it just looks expensive, but it's a tax rate that explains the difference. The second what if I asked was, what if keeping everything else constant, I increase my capex, my net capex goes up? So the growth rate stays the same, my net capex goes up, my EV to EBITDA decreases. Why? Because I have to invest more to get the same growth. I'm less efficient, I'll pay a lower multiple of EBITDA. In the third graph, I've converted the reinvestment rate into a return on capital and looked at the at what would happen to my EV to EBITDA as my return on capital increases. So basically what I have here is returns on capital ranging from 6% to 16%. And I've looked at three scenarios, a cost of capital of 8, 9, and 10%. With every cost of capital, the EV to EBITDA increases, but the lower the cost of capital, the bigger the impact of having a high return on capital. So again, the reason we're doing this is not to plug variables in to get into that equation, but to get a sense of what questions to ask or what to control for when you compare across companies. Let's do one final EV multiple because we looked at EV to invested capital, we've looked at EV to EBITDA, let's look at EV to sales. Again, I'm going to cut to the chase. I'm not going to torture you by doing the algebra again, but here's what I did. I went to a two-stage growth model for a firm because EV is a firm valuation. And I converted that equation for a two-stage valuation into an EV to sales. Let me cut to the chase. The EV to sales is now on my left-hand side. I have reinvestment rate, growth, and cost of capital, which are kind of almost constants every time you have an EV multiple. They showed up with EV to EBITDA, they show up here as well. But now you've got after-tax operating margins showing up. Remember we talked about companion variables in the last session? I said every multiple has a companion variable, the one number you want to ask about before you decide that the company's cheap or expensive. If I come to you with a retail firm trading at 30% of revenues, and they say the typical retail firm trades at 0.6 times revenues, this firm trades at 0.3 times revenues, it must be cheap. And you're allowed to ask only one question. You know what that question should be? What kind of after-tax operating margin did your company have last year? My company is probably a discount retailer making 2% margins, or a grocery store. Those companies tend to have low EV to sales ratios because their margins tend to be low. So with every multiple, you're trying to extract the variables and find the variable that you should be most focused on when you use that multiple. Now, I'm going to use the EV to sales ratio to try to answer a question that many people are interested in. In fact, in valuation, it often pops up after the fact. In what sense? You've done a valuation of a company. It has a brand name, and the company is convinced that the brand name has value. We don't know that. Every company claims to have a brand name value, and they come to say, we should have a higher value because we have a brand name. And we talked a little bit about this when we talked about the loose sense and valuation with Coca-Cola, how it's already embedded in your value. But let's say you're pricing a company and you're saying, look, I'm pricing a brand name company against other companies in my sector that don't have that brand name, or Coca-Cola against other cola manufacturers. How would I attach a value to the brand name? I'm going to argue that the EV to sales setup that we have actually allows us to do this, because here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to compute the EV to sales ratio for my brand name company with its margin. And remember, it's going to have much higher margins. And then I'm going to compute the EV to sales ratio for exactly the same company, assuming it loses its margin, or basically it goes to becoming a generic company. And the difference then will be the value of my brand name. So there's my Coca-Cola brand name. And to do this, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to first, and this is from about 15 years ago, it was a student of mine who worked at Coca-Cola in the top management team. And he came to me and he said, can you come into Atlanta and talk to our management team about the value of our brand name? We're all convinced that Coca-Cola is a significant brand name. So I went through the process of valuing Coca-Cola using a traditional discounted cash flow model. And you've seen me do discounted cash flow models. I told a story, I put up the cash flows, I discounted the cash flows, I complete the value of the firm. I come up with the value of 79.6 billion. I get ready to move on. And a guy in the front row, must have been head marketing honcho, puts up his hand and he says, you forgot something very important. And I said, what did I forget? He said, you forgot the fact that Coca-Cola is the most valuable brand name in the world. And I said, what exactly do you want me to do? He said, you should be adding at least a 20% premium to the value. And I said, why? He said, because that's what we do at Coca-Cola when we buy brand name companies in other countries. He said, we value the company and then we add a 20% premium. And I said, just because you have the brand name value doesn't mean I have to. This is exactly the example we did with the loose sense. So essentially what I've done here is I've computed the EV to sales ratio for Coca-Cola and with the brand name, and then I've replaced Coca-Cola's brand name, which is 15.57%, with a much lower margin. Those are the margins for Cott, the Canadian soda manufacturer. And essentially I've given Coca-Cola Cott's margins. This isn't a valuation of Coca-Cola versus a valuation of Cott. It's a valuation of Coca-Cola with its own margins, which are really high, 15.57%. And then a valuation of Coca-Cola with much lower margins, reflecting the generic company. So I value Coca-Cola, I get 79.6 billion. I value Coca-Cola with Cott's margins, I get 15.4 billion. That difference of 64.2 billion is the value of Coca-Cola's brand name. So essentially, I value Coca-Cola's brand name by looking to see what would happen to its margins if it lost its brand name. So this works really well for companies like Coca-Cola with the most significant, perhaps the only competitive advantage is brand name. But you can see already by extracting the variables that drive a multiple, you can now use it to compare across companies and to control for differences. So at this point, you should have a sense of what the variables are that drive each multiple. So if you have an equity multiple, as I said, go back to an equity valuation model, a stable growth dividend discount model. And using that, we got the variables that drive price earnings. The variables that drive price earnings are cost of equity, growth, and payout. Price to book is cost of equity, growth, and payout, and return on equity adds on. That's a companion variable. Price to sales, not an internally consistent multiple, but there are some people insist on using it. It's return on equity, cost of equity, growth, payout, and net margin. And dividend yield is driven by cost of equity and growth rate. So if you look at equity multiples, every equity multiple I can trace back to an equity discounted cash flow model and extract the variables that drive that multiple. With enterprise value multiples, I start with an enterprise value model. And then I use it to extract the variables that drive each multiple. Enterprise value to free cash flow to the firm is a function of cost of capital and growth rate. So you tell me you're going to pay 5 times free cash flow to the firm, I'm going to ask you, what's your cost of capital? What's your growth rate? Enterprise value to after-tax operating income is a function of my reinvestment rate, my cost of capital, and my growth rate. And again, all I'm doing is taking my model and doing algebra. EV to EBIT is a function of my tax rate, my reinvestment rate, my cost of capital, and my growth rate. And EV to sales, you already saw. You saw margin pop up, and EV to invested capital is return on invested capital. So work on this process, because I think it's a job of analysts to keep inventing multiples you've never seen before. Market value per website visitor, market value per user. And if you're religious about going back to a discounted cash flow model, you should be able to extract what the variables are that drive that multiple and what questions you should be asking that person when he says, pay me $300 per subscriber. So that is the definitional, that is the analytical test. We're looking to see the variables that drive each multiple. Let's talk about the application test. So here we're asking, now that I'm going to be pricing this company, what should I compare it to? What are my comparable firms? I know in conventional practice, this is almost always defined as the sector you're in. So if you're a software company, you're compared to other software companies. If you're a steel company, you're compared to other steel companies. I understand the drive for doing this, but it's not really what you need to be doing, because in valuation, a comparable company is one with similar cash flows, similar growth, and similar risk. Nowhere in there is there mention of what sector you're in. Nothing stops me from comparing my company to companies in other sectors which have exactly the same cash flow, growth, and risk characteristics. So while you might use sectors to do your comparison, remember you have a much bigger space to be working in, the entire market, to look for identical firms. So the first question of what should be a comparable firm, maybe we need to expand our definition beyond the sector. Now, once you've got those comparable firms, no matter how careful you've been, you need to adjust for differences across companies on the fundamentals, because it's impossible to find a company just like yours. You need to control for differences. So we're going to go through that process by looking at two questions every one of you is going to face. So I'm going to put you on the spot again. Many of you have turned in your DCFs. I've been tardy about returning your DCFs, but I promise you will get them back. That's the first and the biggest part of your project. The second phase of your project, I'm going to ask you to price your company. To price your company, you've got to find comparable companies, right? And given that you have access to S&P Capital IQ, finding the comparable companies is not going to be difficult. It's just running a screen. But one of the choices you'll have to make is, do you go for a small sample of companies just like yours or a much larger sample? Let me give you an example. Let's suppose you're valuing a Latin American, a Brazilian steel company. You might say, look, I want to look at only other Brazilian steel companies, which means your sample size is going to be tiny, maybe 2 or 3 companies. Maybe you can expand it to Latin American steel companies. Maybe you can get 12 or 13. Maybe it can be North American or American steel companies, where you can bring in US companies. That'll bring the sample size to 25, or you can go to global, which could give you hundreds of companies. Maybe you want to look at companies only like your company in terms of size. You want your companies mid-size, you want only mid-size companies. Every criteria you add to your I want companies just like mine will make your sample smaller. And if you remove that criteria, your sample get bigger. So one of the questions you will face is, do I want to go to with a small sample of companies that look more like mine? Or do I want to go with a larger sample of companies and risk companies that are not going to be like mine because they're in different markets, different sizes, different growth levels? I'll give you my priors. I'm a great believer in the law of large numbers. I like larger samples. I'd much rather do my pricing against a sample of 50 companies, but the companies have differences from mine, than a sample of 4. But then I have to control for those differences. So the sampling choice has to go with, how do you control for differences? If you're just going to just compare the companies, eyeball the numbers, you can't have a big sample. So I'll give you a classic example. Let's suppose you're pricing Uber. If you define comparable as other publicly traded ride-sharing companies, How many companies are going to be in a sample? Hey, there's only one. It's Lyft. So you compare Uber to Lyft and Lyft to Uber. It's a direct comparison. You're saying they're both ride-sharing companies. They should trade at the same pricing. That's a direct comparison. You can do it only if you have two companies. For a century in the U.S., auto analysts have compared GM to Ford, and for a short period, or a period when Chrysler was still around, GM, Ford, and Chrysler, those were the three companies. They priced them against each other. Small samples, direct comparisons. The second is if your sample gets a little bigger than three, six or seven or eight, you tell a story. And here's how it works. Let's say you're looking at a chemical company, it's trading at 12 times earnings, but the rest of the chemical sector trades at 10 times earnings. At first sight, your company looks expensive, right? But you say, no, it's not really expensive because it has higher growth than the rest of the chemical sector. You're telling a story. The story is incomplete because the higher growth should give you a higher multiple of earnings, but why 12? Why not 11 and a half? But storytelling is often equity research analysts' preferred choice for controlling for differences. The third is you can modify the multiple for what you think sets a company apart. Let me go back to my Uber and Lyft example. If I look at the revenue multiple for Uber, it turns out to be higher than the revenue multiple for Lyft. Uber trades at a higher multiple of revenues. You say, well, that makes Uber expensive. But then you say, no, wait, but Uber has far more riders than Lyft does. And maybe that's the reason it's trading at a higher price. You know how I can incorporate that? Rather than dividing the enterprise value by revenues, I can divide by number of riders. And on an enterprise value to rider basis, Uber looks less expensive. I'm modifying the multiple to incorporate the effect of whatever I think I need to worry about. Remember PEG ratios? This is where PEG ratios are born. People want to control for differences in growth. They brought the growth into the multiple. But I'll give you my preferred choice because I like large samples of 50, 60, 70 companies, or even 25 companies. I can't do direct comparisons. Storytelling makes me dizzy. How many stories can you tell? I can't modify the multiple easily, so I draw on statistics. I use the chapter and statistics on multiple regressions. A chapter I never thought I'd need after my statistics class, but it's turned out to be incredibly useful to control for differences. So how big is your sample? How are you going to control for differences? So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take you through a series of examples. And I'm going to play the role of an equity research analyst, a naive equity research analyst. And I want you to find the holes in my story, what I'm missing with each of these examples. So let's start by, I'm going to be the beverage analyst. This is way back in time. Some of these companies might not even be around. So let's say it's whichever year that I pulled up this data. I show you the sample of beverage companies. And I'm going to put a buy recommendation on a couple of these companies. I'm going to put a buy recommendation on André Wine and Hansen Natural. Let me take you back to the previous page. Can you see why I picked those two companies? They're two of the three companies that trade at less than 10 times earnings. In fact, to be consistent, I should have probably also picked Todhunter. They all trade at low PE. I told you I was a naive analyst. I picked these stocks based on low PEs. So shoot me down. Let's take André Wine. They have a low PE, or Todhunter. Low PE, but what could explain that low PE? I've kind of given away the game, right? Because in the second column, I have the expected growth rate of these companies. And guess what? André Wine and Todhunter have the lowest growth rates. If you've never heard of André Wine, they make champagne so cheap that looking at, I think the only time I've ever seen that the commercials for their champagne is around Christmas. And I get a headache just watching the commercials. The champagne is that cheap. So you can already see André Wine and Todhunter have the lowest growth rates, and that's why they have the lowest PE ratios. Okay. So that explains it. I messed up. But what about Hansen Natural? It looks cheap and it has a high growth rate. Have I found a bargain here? Well, let's look at the last column. What do you have here? The standard deviation in stock price is a rough proxy for the risk in the company. Hansen Natural looks cheap, but it's also the riskiest stock in the market. Do you see what's happened here? André Wine and Hansen Natural look cheap on a PE ratio basis, but André Wine has a really low growth rate, and that explains the PE ratio, and Hansen Natural is really high risk. I'm not saying that you can't buy either of these stocks, but I'm saying there are holes in my argument, and it's my job as an equity research analyst to defend against those holes in the argument, and I did not do that, so guess what happened? I got fired. So here's my second job. I've landed on my feet. I'm now the telecom analyst. and this is the late 90s, and these are all foreign telecom companies that are listed in the US. That's what an ADR is. It's a listing of a foreign telecom in the US. The advantage of ADRs in the late 90s is, at least in theory, they were covered by GAAP. So they all were using accounting that was consistent. Remember, we said you should have uniform standards, and these are the PE ratios. So again, I'm going to put a buy recommendation on Telebras. You see why I like Telebras? Low PE ratio. In fact, Telebras and Indosat would probably be my buy recommendations. But again, before I get carried away, tell me what I might be missing when I focus on Telebras as a cheap company. Look at the second column. Here's one of my problems, right? Telebras and Indosat have the lowest growth rate. All these growth rates are in US dollars. So that growth rate is low. Maybe that explains low P. You know, the other thing that worries me is, if you look across these stocks, you've got the Indonesian telecom company, the Brazilian telecom company, the New Zealand telecom company, the French telecom company, the Greek telecom company, the Chilean telecom company. You see, so what? Some of these telecom companies are emerging market telecom companies. Some are developed market telecom companies. And these were the 1990s, when emerging market companies were much riskier than developed market companies. So you know what I did? I basically decided to open my statistics book. And I said, look, two things worry about me about Telebras. One is the low growth rate. The other is the fact that it's an emerging market company with more risk. But I can't eyeball this data, tell stories. I'm going to draw on statistics. And here's how statistics helps me. What's a variable I'm trying to explain? PE ratios, right? What are the two things that I'm worried about? Growth rate and the fact that some of these companies are emerging market companies and some are developed market companies. So I ran a regression of PE ratio. So basically I'm taking the sample, running a regression of PE ratio against the growth rate. That's one variable, and a dummy variable. Remember what dummy variables are? They take on a value of 0 or 1. Here I've set them to 0 if it's a developed market telecom. So France and New Zealand, they'll be set to 0. And 1 if it's an emerging market telecom. Brazil and Indonesia, I set them to 1. I run the regression. Now, when you run a regression, the output from the regression comes out. And I used a regression package. I actually might have even used Excel. And here's what the output gave me. It said that my intercept was 13.12. What does that tell me? That's a base from which I'm going to build. It's not much more than that. Every 1% increase in growth rates across telecom companies increases my PE ratio by 1.21. Think about it. If your growth rate is 5% higher than mine, your PE ratio will be 6 higher than mine, 5 times 1.21. So I've quantified the effect of growth, at least in the telecom sector. And then I got to the emerging market dummy. And it says minus 13.85. You're saying, what does that even mean? If I have two telecom companies, one is a developed market telecom, and the other is an emerging market telecom. The emerging market telecom will have a PE ratio 13.85 lower than the developed market telecom. The late 90s, markets were punishing emerging market companies much more than they do now. So you ready? Remember that Telebras recommendation I made? I said that 8.9 times earnings, it looks cheap. I went in and plugged in Telebras' growth rate and the fact that it's an emerging market company into the regression to come up with a predicted PE of 8.35. You're saying, what does that even tell me? Given its low growth and the fact it's an emerging market company, I would expect the PE to be 8.35. At 8.9 times earnings, Telebras is actually slightly overvalued, not undervalued. That's what I mean about using statistical tools to break the impasse. Essentially, look for what drives your multiple. It'll allow you to get past the storyteller. So I get fired as the telecom analyst. I land on my feet, and now I'm the European bank analyst in 2010. And here's what European banks look like in 2010. I've listed out their price-to-book ratios in the second column, the returns on equity, and standard deviations. Before I go any further, remember the variables that drive price-to-book. Are the things remaining equal, higher return on equity companies should have higher price-to-book ratios, right? And other things remaining equal, higher risk companies should have lower price-to-book ratios. Even eyeballing the data, you can see that that tends to be true. As your return equity increases, your price-to-book goes up, and as your standard deviation increases, your price-to-book goes down. But again, storytelling can get you only so far. So here's another device that's not statistical, but pretty intuitive. See this median that I've computed in the last row? The median price to book is 2.07. The median return equity is 11.82%. The median standard deviation is 21.93%. Let's play a little game. If you want a cheap stock, you want a stock that trades at a price to book less than the median or more than the median? Oh, less than the median, okay. You want a price to book less than 2.07. You want a return on equity less than the median or greater than the median? Remember, you want a cheap stock, so you want a low price to book and you want a high return equity. So you want a return equity greater than the median, right? Yeah. There's only one there. So basically, I'm looking for stocks with a price to book less than the median, a return equity greater than the median, 12.4. So basically, I have BNP Paribas maybe, and that's about it, right? That's the only stock that seems to come through. But then I need a third screen. I want a standard deviation less than the median or more than the median. I want less risky stocks, low price to book, high return equity. And I want stocks. So basically, I want a stock that trades at price to book less than 2.07, a return on equity greater than 11.82%, and a standard deviation less than 21.93%. I don't find a single company here that'll meet my requirements. In fact, the closest I might get is Royal Bank of Scotland. And even it has a price to book slightly above the median. So all I've done here is used a very simple process of using the medians, looking for stocks above the median or below the median, depending on whether I'm looking for price to book or return equity. And conversely, if I want overvalued stocks, I want stocks that trade above the median price to book, have returns on equity lower than the sector median, and have standard deviations lower than the median. You're saying that wasn't very useful. I mean, nothing came out as cheap or expensive. So I'm going to go back to my statistical approach. Remember the regression approach? I ran a regression of price to book ratios for European banks against return on equity and standard deviation. Look at this R squared, 79%. The T statistics all passed muster. Remember the cutoff for two? So basically, I have a regression that is statistically significant. Now, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take each company's return equity and standard deviation and plug it into the regression. The regression output came from running the regression. And here's what I get. For bearish hypo, whatever, it's German bank with a price to book of 0.80. If I plug in the return equity and standard deviation, the predicted price to book I get is 0.89. So at 0.8 times book value, it is slightly undervalued by about 10.6%. Conversely, if I look at Bank Intesa, price to book ratio 1.66, the predicted price to book I get with that return equity and that standard deviation is 1.41. It looks overvalued by about 18%. In fact, the most overvalued bank, at least when I did this in 2010, was an East European bank called Erste, 23.11%. The most undervalued bank, I'm looking for the most negative number, was Royal Bank of Scotland. Minus 16.65%. I'm not suggesting again that you turn your equity research over to a statistical tool, but use the statistical tool to kind of break the tie, to decide whether something is cheap or expensive because it beats the storytelling that you're doing. So let's go to a fourth example. As your sample size gets bigger, it's good to visualize the data. You know what I mean by that? That regression, I gave you the equation, you're saying, where the heck did that equation come from? Sometimes it's more intuitive if you look at the regression on a scatter plot. You know? So here what I've done is I've taken the largest firms, I think the 100 largest companies in the US in January 2010. I took their price to book ratios and returns on equity. And each of these points is a company. It's called a scatter plot. You're saying, what are these lines? This middle line is my regression line, fit through. It's the best fit line. The two outer lines are my 90% confidence intervals. Basically, because when you run a regression, you get a range on your forecast. So what I'm looking for are stocks that fall outside of these. Let me explain. See, there are three stocks that fall above the line. Google, Infosys, and Gilead. Now, the points that fall between the two lines, I cannot reject the hypothesis they're fairly valued. They're all falling within the regression bounds. But Google, Infosys, and Gilead, are they the most overvalued, overpriced stocks or the most underpriced stocks? They fall above the line. Oh, they are the most overpriced stocks. And already you can see a limitation to what I've done. By looking at just price to book and return equity, I've ignored growth. And remember we said higher growth companies should have a higher price to book. Google, Infosys, and Gilead might be overpriced, or they just might be the highest growth companies. At the time that I did this in 2010, three companies fell below the line, barely. ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, and Nokia. Well, the fact that two of them are oil companies should make me a little suspicious, because when you get a bunch of companies looking overpriced, underpriced from the same sector, it might be something going on during the sector. They were, the, and what happened in 2010 was oil prices had dropped and the oil companies had dropped in pricing. So what does this graph tell me? At least it gives me a first set of where should I be looking for mispriced stocks? Because remember, even if you're a true believer in intrinsic valuation, you can't value 100 companies over the period of a day. You might be able to value three. And you say, where do I start? This scatter plot will give you a way of starting. But as I said, it's a scatter plot of price to book against return equity and not factoring in growth. Is there a way I could keep this a scatter plot and bring in growth? Yes, and it's a little confusing. It's a three-dimensional graph. And what do you have in this graph? A price to book on one axis, return on equity in the next axis, and growth in the third one. So I'm plotting all 100 of my companies in that box. Let me ask you a question. Where in this box are my cheap stocks? Let's look at the combination you want. You want low price to book, you want high return equity, and you want high growth. Low price to book, high return equity, high growth. The stocks that are in this corner are my cheapest stocks. The closest I get is Time Warner. The further away I get is Gilead. So again, if you want to bring in a third dimension, do so, but don't get so hopelessly confused that you don't know where you're going. So low price to book, high return equity, high growth. You're looking for that combination, and that combination is going to be your cheapest stock. Now, incidentally, if I wanted to do this on risk, because that's the other missing variable, riskier stocks should have lower price, should have lower price to book ratios. My best combination here is low price to book, high return equity, low risk. There are my cheap stocks in that corner. The closest I get is ExxonMobil. You see, why do we waste our time? Because it doesn't look like this approach works. Remember, these are the 100 largest stocks companies in the US. I'd be very surprised if any of them were so severely mispriced that they would pop up on a scatter plot like this one. You know where this might work? If you took 100 small companies and you did this, hey, maybe you'd find a company that people have ignored. And a time like this one, where you have a crisis around you and you have no idea what people are doing to stocks, might be a good time to run these scatter plots to look for bargains. Finally, I took my statistical toolbox out again and I ran a regression across those larger stocks. The R squared again was pretty impressive, 66.1%. And here's my output from the regression. So this is my 100 largest companies. My intercept was 0.41. Every increase in beta 1 lowered my price to book ratio by 0.065. Every increase in growth rate by 1% increased my price to book by 0.09. And every increase of return equity by 1% increased my price to book by 0.10. You're saying, how would I use this? You give me one of the 100 companies. Hey, is this company underpriced or overpriced relative to the other 99? I'd plug the company's beta, growth rate, and return equity into this regression, get a predicted price to book, and compare to the actual price to book. It's a quick and dirty way of doing equity research. So I decided to update this at the start of January 2020. And in fact, the price to book ratios for almost all of these companies has dropped pretty significantly over the last 3 months. But this was the start of the year. I took price to book against return equity. So the every point here is a company. I drew the regression line. There's the regression line. R squared is not bad, 49%. The two outside lines are the 90th percentiles. And remember, my measure of expensive and cheap is the companies lie above the line, they're expensive. The companies that lie below the line, they're cheap. So two of the companies are not surprises. One is Tesla and the other is Netflix. They look expensive and they are expensive stocks given their return equity. You could argue that with Tesla and Netflix, maybe you should bring growth in. I haven't done that because those three-dimensional graphs make me dizzy. I looked for stocks below the line and I couldn't find any. There was nothing in the market that looked significantly underpriced enough to fall below the line. In fact, there were VRTX and so basically these two stocks at the very bottom are the ones that come closest, but even they're not underpriced. So if you use this approach, my suggestion is try it on a group of stocks which are not as widely followed as 100 largest market cap companies. Let's do price to book against return equity. and it works really well in financial service companies. So if you want to do this just for financial service companies, try price to book against return equity and see what looks underpriced, overpriced. Let's move on to a fifth example. I'm not a great fan of the trucking sector. I find it incredibly boring, but it's a sector that analysts do follow. And I'm now the trucking analyst, and here's my sectors. I have a list of companies, and I have their EV to EBITDA multiples in the last column. You ready? I'm going to put a buy recommendation on a company, and it's a company I think you might have heard of. And I want you to ask me the questions, because that's really what pricing should be about, asking the right questions. So I said EV to EBITDA for Ryder Systems is 2.81. I'm going to put a buy on Ryder Systems. You ever heard of Ryder Systems? Ryder trucks are moving trucks. You can rent them. It's been around. It's one of the larger companies in the sector, right? 2.8 times EBITDA, it looks cheap. Ask me the questions. Okay, let's list out the variables that drive EV to EBITDA. The first is tax rate. So the first question you're going to ask is, what kind of tax rate does Ryder Systems have? Maybe it's in a state that has a 50% tax rate. No, that's not true. Its tax rate is very similar to everybody else's. So that's not it. So what's its cost of capital? Maybe it's an emerging market company. No, it's a US company which gets most of its revenues in the US. That's not the problem. Maybe it has negative growth and every other company in the sector is fast growing. No, they're all slow growing companies, including Ryder Systems. So it's not the tax rate, it's not the cost of capital, it's not the growth rate. What's the only other variable? Or what's the return on capital? They're all pretty mediocre, 8-9%. No, but Ryder Systems is no lower than everybody else. You know, the only one left over variable is the reinvestment rate. So what's my reinvestment rate? And here I have to let you in on a secret in how trucking companies reinvest. They don't reinvest smoothly. They often replace their entire fleet every 4 or 5 years because they get better prices. So ask me the question about Ryder. When did they last replace their fleet? Okay, I want you to guess, given that they're trading at a low EV to EBITDA, do they have the oldest fleet in this sector or the youngest fleet? They happen to have the oldest fleet. You know why the EV to EBITDA is so low? Because the market knows that in a couple of months, Ryder Systems is going to be issuing a couple of $1 billion of capital to raise money to replace its entire fleet. The market's not stupid. The market value is down because there's a huge reinvestment coming up. I actually pulled this buy recommendation from an actual equity research report. The analyst had put a buy on Ryder because its EV to EBITDA was low. And I was able to pull up these numbers in the life of the fleet on every one of these companies. The analysts had never bothered to do it. That's what I mean when I say there's nothing wrong with pricing. The problem with pricing is people are too lazy. They don't want to ask those questions and collect the data you need to make sure you're not controlling, you're not missing something that explains why the price is what it is. So when you look at EV to EBITDA multiples for infrastructure companies, one of the things you should expect is as infrastructure companies finish their reinvestment phase, they will trade at higher and higher multiples of EBITDA. You know what I mean by that? You have a toll road company. It's starting its life. It's going to just start building toll roads. It'll be trading at a much lower EV to EBITDA than when the toll roads get completed. In fact, the more mature an infrastructure company becomes, you know, it's living off its past investment, the higher the EV to EBITDA is going to be. Sixth example, let's look at grocery stores. And here I'm going to break my rule in consistency. And rather than use EV to sales, I'll use price to sales. Now, I know I'm supposed to use EV to sales. The story would have been just as good with EV to sales. So I looked at EV to sales for grocery stores in 2007. Very boring business, right? Look, if you take them and put them on a scatter plot of EV of price to sales against net margin, because equity multiple, equity margin, I get almost every grocery store between the bands. And then there is the outlier, Whole Foods. Whole Foods looks overpriced, right? But how do you explain it? Whole Foods was a grocery store, but its margin was 3.41%, significantly higher than the net margin of the other grocery stores. So if I were to stop you as an equity research analyst and you put a buy recommendation on Whole Foods, you say, how can you ask me to buy the stock? It looks expensive. Your defense is that's much higher margins. But you see the problem with that defense? Even if I run a regression across these companies and plug in the higher net margin in, my predicted price to sales ratio for Whole Foods is 0.43, much higher than it would be for almost any other grocery store. But it wouldn't be 1.4 times revenues. So in 2007, notwithstanding their high margin, my argument with Whole Foods is they're overpriced. Let's move forward, 2009. Whole Foods had a couple of bad years. I redid the analysis, same grocery stores, and I drew the lines again. Do you see where Whole Foods is now? It's actually towards the bottom end of the spectrum. It's gone from being the most expensive grocery store to the cheapest grocery store. It doesn't fall below the line, but on a relative basis, it's the cheapest grocery store. Again, I've controlled for margins. Its margins have decreased, and with those decreased margins, I should be at 0.36 times revenues. It's actually trading at 0.2 times revenues. Whole Foods has become from the most overpriced stock to the most underpriced. Okay, let's go forward to 2010. I reran the regression again. Do you see where Whole Foods is now? Whole Foods is back to being overpriced. See, what's going on here? It's looking like a manic depressive company, right? Overpriced, underpriced, overpriced, overpriced again. And then in 2015, before I go to 2015, in 2011, when I ran this regression, Whole Foods was finally on the line. I'll tell you what I think happens when you have a company that's different from the sector. And Whole Foods was a standout when it came about. Investors don't know what to do with the company. So they overshoot, they undershoot, they overshoot, they undershoot until they finally figure the company out. It took investors about 5 years to figure out what to do with Whole Foods before they found a way to price it right. And in 2015, when I looked at the grocery market, you see the new kid in town? It's Sprouts. Again, people are messing up on Sprouts. Again, very different from the rest of the sector. There's a broader lesson here. When you have a company that comes into a sector that is very different from the rest of the sector, investors don't know what to do with the company. They overshoot and then they undershoot. They overshoot and undershoot, which means if you're doing intrinsic valuation, those are the companies we are most likely to find incredible mispricing. So that's why I've spent so much time valuing Tesla in the last 8 years. Tesla is an automobile company that the investors in auto companies have no idea what to do with. They screw up all the time. And that's why with Tesla, you're going to get that mispricing continue for extended periods. Let's do a seventh example. In every one of the examples I've done so far, the regression worked pretty well, right? The R squareds were 30, 40, even 70%. The T statistics look good. And I was able to use the regression to predict what multiple my company should trade at. Well, that's all often, sometimes not the case. In early 2000, right after I valued Amazon at 84, remember we did that DCF valuation of Amazon on the dark side, where I found Amazon to be significantly overvalued, I decided to price Amazon. I said, what's it? And to price Amazon, I looked at the rest of the dot-com sector, and I drew a scatter plot of price to sales against margin. It's the first thing you, when you look at the scatter plot and ask you to draw a best fit line, what's your reaction? I can't find a best fit line. There's almost no relationship. This looks like a shotgun blast. Undaunted, I decided to run the regression anyway to see what I'd get, and I got an R squared of 4%. And when I looked at the regression, the T statistic was 0.49. In fact, it was scary. The coefficient of net margin was negative. The more negative your net margin, because almost all of these companies had negative net margins, the higher your price to sales ratio. In a strange way, it captured the ethos of the dot-com boom, right? Where people were pricing these stocks, and the more money they lost, the higher the price they attached. But this regression is absolutely useless. It tells me nothing about Amazon. So I had to reframe the analysis so I could price Amazon. And I'll give you two ways you can do it. One is, instead of running a regression of price to sales against margins, growth, payout, all the traditional variables, I asked a different question. I said, look, I know nobody's pricing these stocks now based on how much money they make or what their margins are. They're pricing them on faith that they will survive. So the higher the likelihood that they will survive, the greater the multiple should be. Second, they're pricing them based on how much revenue they have. If you have tiny revenues, you could trade at 100 times revenues, but if your revenues are a billion, your multiple should get lower. So it should be a function of revenues. And it should also be a function of growth. Higher growth companies should trade at higher price to sales ratios. So I said, I want to control for survival. I want to control for growth. I want to control for how much revenues they have. So I ran a regression of dot-com stocks, price to sales ratio, against the level of revenues. I took the log, the natural log of revenues. I'll talk about why the natural log is almost a magical transformation. It allows you to get statistics that actually are much more usable for your company. So that's a level of revenues. And the higher my revenues, the lower the price to sales ratio. That makes sense. If you have 3 billion revenues, I can't sell at 100 times revenues. The higher my growth rate, the higher my price to sales ratio. And the more cash I have as a company, the higher my price. You're saying, why does cash even matter? We talked about surviving. If you're a young dot-com company, the way you often failed was you ran out of cash. The more cash you have, the greater the chance of surviving. Well, at least revenue growth and cash as a percent of revenues have significant T statistics. I left the level of revenues in, though I should probably have taken it out given the low T statistic. And I plugged the numbers in for Amazon into this regression. Log of Amazon's revenues, Amazon's growth rate was 199%, and Amazon's cash as a percent of revenues was 30.69%. I got a predicted price to sales ratio for Amazon of 30.42. You're saying, what am I going to do with that? Amazon's actual price to sales was 25.63. So given its fundamentals and given how the rest of the dot-com sector is being priced, they should be priced at 30 times revenues. They were actually being priced at 26 times revenues. Stock is underpriced relative to other dot-com stocks. Remember, I did this right after I did that DCF valuation. If you remember, I told you that Amazon was significantly overvalued, right? At $84, you're saying, how can Amazon be both overvalued and underpriced at the same time? You see how? When I valued Amazon, I valued it relative to its cash flows, growth, and risk. And based on the intrinsic value, I said it's overvalued. Here, what's the question I'm asking? Given how other dot-com stocks are being traded, is Amazon under or overpriced? It's underpriced. It's cheap relative to other dot-com stocks, but it's expensive relative to its intrinsic value. You say, what should I do then? Buy or sell? Well, it depends on whether you're an investor who believes in value, in which case you'd sell short or sell the stock. Or you're a trader, in which case, what are you doing? You're buying low, you're selling high, in which case you might take advantage of this and buy Amazon at 25.6 times revenues and hope it goes to 30.4 times revenues. Now, the other solution you can use, is, and this is especially going to be the case when you have a young company, you're trying to value price Uber or Lyft or Square, is rather than use this year's numbers. The reason you're having trouble with multiples is this year's numbers have very little substance. The company has low revenues, it's losing money. What if you could forecast what those numbers will be in the future? Use a forward multiple. Now, when you do this, you got to be careful because what you will get then is a value way out in the future. So if you tell me your earnings in year five will be 500, and you say my price earnings ratio will be 20. 20 times 500 is 10 billion, but that's in year five. You got to bring it back to today. And to show you how much of a discounting there will be on that number, I'm going to show you a valuation I did of Tesla way back 2014. My expected value in year 10, my terminal value is 68.27. Just the time value of that at the risk-free rate is at just 2.75%, then lowers the 68 billion to 52 billion. So that's just discounting back at the risk-free rate. Discounting back at the extra premium, because I'm a risky company, lowers the 50. So basically by discounting, time value of money alone will knock the value down from 68 to 28 billion. So often when you use forward multiples, you're getting a value way out in the future. You got to discount today using your cost of capital. But even that's not quite the value today, because remember, to get to that end game, I've got to come up with cash flows for those first 3 or 4 years where I have negative cash flows. So when I adjusted for those negative cash flows, and this is what happens automatically in your DCF, but you have to do it explicitly when you do pricing, is I've taken the present value of my negative cash flows for the first 4 or 5 years. When I have to come up with those cash flows, that lowers my present value to 12.8 billion. There was a 10% chance of failure, that lowers my value to 12.2 billion. And then I adjust for debt and cash and options, I'm down to 8 billion. A $68 billion forward value has become an $8 billion current value for equity. That's a huge discounting. And that's something analysts should be careful about when they use forward earnings to get a forward value. It's not only discounted back today, but adjust for all those other bites of the apple that will take chunks out of your value. Finally, when you do pricing, you don't have to follow the script. Basically, you have to look at what the market's pricing it. So this was about 6 years ago when I valued Twitter at the time of their IPO. So I did a traditional valuation. I came up with the value of about $18 per share at the time of their IPO. But then I wanted to price Twitter. They're saying, what does that mean, price Twitter? Well, I wanted to see how the market was pricing other social media companies. So there's the list of companies. These are the social media companies. There are the market caps, publicly traded companies. And I looked up a bunch of fundamentals, enterprise value, revenues, EBITDA, net income. But I also looked up the number of users. Right? So I wanted to see what are the variables that best explain difference in pricing. So I'll show you what I found when I ran a correlation matrix, another statistical tool that we seldom use, between market cap and EBITDA, revenues, net income, and number of users. So look across the variables. And you can already see that the variable that best explains differences in market cap is number of users. Go back to the previous page. I computed enterprise value per user. So just take the EV and divide by number of users. I've got an EV per user. It varies across companies. It is very high for Netflix. Why? It's a subscription-based business. And among the user-based companies, it's very high for Facebook and Groupon. But the median value across these companies is about $97. So you say, what does that tell you? Roughly speaking, the market seems to be paying about $100 per user. You think, how am I going to use this? At the time of its IPO, Twitter had 240 million users. You multiply 240 million by 100, you get about 24 billion. That's my pricing of Twitter. You're saying, that is really simplistic. Pricing is supposed to be simple. That's why we use it. So when you're trying to price something, you're trying to look at what is the market pricing in and then trying to price your company based on that metric. And in 2013, the market was pricing in users. All it cared about was how many users do you have? And guess what? The companies learned that. So every earnings report, guess what the company's focused on? We have more users. Look, we have even more users. Eventually, the market turned towards how much do you have in revenues and earnings and cash flows. I call those bar mitzvah moments. But until that happened, it was users, users, and still more users. Just as an aside, I don't know whether you remember when Facebook bought WhatsApp in 2011, 12, some, you know, maybe 12 or 13, for 19 billion. And when Facebook paid 19 billion for WhatsApp, people said, are they crazy? Because at that time, WhatsApp had almost no revenues because almost everybody using WhatsApp was using the free version. No revenues, of course, was losing money. So people said, this makes no sense. Why is Facebook paying 19 billion for WhatsApp? And I actually wrote a post at the time, and if I get a chance, I'll send you the link to it, on a potential explanation. I said, look, here's what Facebook's doing. It's playing the game the market is paying it to play, which is users. At the time that it bought WhatsApp, WhatsApp didn't have much in revenues, but it had 400 million users. And many of these users were from parts of the world where Facebook didn't have much of a hold. Asia, for instance, Facebook was weak at that time. WhatsApp had lots of users. So it was buying those users, 400 million users. You think, I wouldn't pay for users. Hey, what's the market paying per user? $100 per user, right? So if you're getting 400 million users, let's say 300 million of them are unique users, users you did not have before you bought WhatsApp. How much will you pay for 300 million users? Based on what the market's paying, 300 million times 100 is 30 billion. How much should Facebook pay for WhatsApp? 19 billion. Using that argument, you can argue that Facebook actually got a bargain when it bought WhatsApp. So I think I should stop there because we've gone through a lot today. But what I'd like you to do is review those examples, pull out your statistics book, or at least read up a little bit on multiple regressions. You don't need to be a statistics geek. You just need to understand what the process of multiple regressions look like. Because when we come back on Monday, and I'll be live on Monday, I'm going to take what I just did with sectors and apply them to the entire market. I'm going to try to run these regressions across the market. And we're going to get some very interesting results when we do that. But I'd like your statistics to be a little stronger when we do it. So give it a shot. And I will talk to you on Monday. Take care.